is Pearland Podcast. I'm in London, and today is very interesting. I have here Kay Eugene, who is an economist and an expert. So I'm really lucky and honored that she's here speaking to us. Kay, can you briefly tell the audience what you do and your career?
Sure, Pearl. Oh, well, it's a pleasure to be here with you. You're so well known in so many circles. So it's a privilege to talk about U.S.-China relations and the rising importance of geopolitics, which is also impacting the art world. And really,
the art world is definitely, with this tariff, 147%.
Well, tariff is everywhere.
Oh, my God.
And present, clear and present danger. My background is that I'm from mainland China. I was born and raised in Beijing. I was an exchange student to U.S. high school. And then I went on to study in the U.S. for a dozen years and got my PhD finally in Boston. And then I became an assistant professor at London School of Economics here in London. And, ever since, I've been trying to work on issues that bridge the East and the West, but really starting from point of view of facts, of evidence, from a macroeconomic point of view. But my latest book, called The New China Playbook, Beyond Socialism and Capitalism, tries to offer a different lens to look through. I think the world, if only using a very narrow Western lens, paints a rather dangerous future, and a future where collaboration is not so possible. So the work that I've been doing, the research that I've been doing macro on recently on U.S.-China technology competition is really about trying to speak the facts, right? Tell the truth, given a different perspective.
You live more than half of your life not in China, right?
Yeah.
So do you consider yourself as Chinese?
That's a great question. I haven't been asked this question in any of my interviews, and I've done plenty for the book promotion. But the short answer is very much so, not only because I spend 4 to 6 months a year in China still, my work is there. But culturally, I feel so very much connected to China. I do love the country. I think for all the challenges and for all the fallacies of any system, it's been a wonderful country that has done so much for its people. And yet, I feel very global. I know it's such a cliche to talk about the globalists, and I'm writing actually another book about how the globalists failed to see the real world.
I love that.
Because I'm a big believer that localism, globalization anchored in deep, true localism, so much grounded into the local network with the local spirit, is so important on so many levels for not just to say
but
success.
But my whole argument about globalization is it manufactures a homogeneous culture.
Yeah.
So when you see, Americanism, Americanization, you have the whole world with a Hollywood movie. Everybody has become part American. So this culture thing with globalization, I thought globalization maybe is good for trading, for trade. Mm-hmm. But when you look at culture, it's disaster.
Yeah, well, there's now a big pushback. And this is what my next project is about. It's about, first of all, this massive diffusion and distribution of opportunity at the local level all around the world. It's no longer just about the core West versus the rest of the world, the core versus the periphery. I think it's an astounding framing that we still use. What do you mean the periphery? Nigeria, China, India, Brazil, the middle powers, Turkey, and all of that, creating their local stratosphere. And then culturally, so rich, the pushback, right? In film, in art, in fashion. I'm also part of a luxury group that I know very well. A lot of the fashion trends are defined there, and with this greater confidence of the local culture. I think number one, it's a pushback against this homogenization. Second is the growing confidence that's afforded by this vast distribution of opportunity there. So all that is to say, I feel Chinese, but I am true at heart, a globalist who's interested in the grounded local events that are happening.
So. Do you see yourself as a bridge?
I hope that I have contributed in my small part to a better understanding of China, at least. And I think that things like my book has done a little bit to do that. But I think there's so many people in my generation, especially from my generation, the younger generation, who is more familiar with a multicultural world, the multilingual environment. They have a softer approach, a more humane approach towards communicating with the West. So I think we all have a role to play in that part.
Let's begin to talk about when you were in high school. So you went from China to her high school, which is completely a different system. You know, American system, even British system is very, very different. And with China, with your Chinese education standard must be much higher than the American standard. When you go there, when you went to study in American high school, you must be, I mean, A grade throughout, right?
I did graduate with the highest GPA in my rather well-established high school in the U.S. But you know what was really fascinating? It totally was a new thing for me because the first day I step in history class, he sat down and said, it's all about questioning authority. Question.
This is for a Chinese girl.
I was like, what do you mean question authority? What do you mean question your textbook? So that was a complete eye-opener. Yeah. You know, when I study in history, when I study history in China, it was all about dates and facts and memorization. Yeah. When I study history in this Mr. DeVito's class, it was all about thinking, about drawing patterns myself, not looking at what the history book tells you, but piecing together firsthand evidence and questioning authority and having the openness of the mind. That was what was just really surprising. Don't be judgmental, you know, be open-minded. And I find that so thrilling, but also so ironic years later when we've lost that in the American mainstream.
Especially now.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Now having an open mind, not being judgmental, and questioning authority and questioning, you know, what's around you, established things. It was really an eye-opening. So even though, you know, the Chinese system was very different and made you master taking exams very well, it completely opened my mind to thinking about things in a very different way, using your brain to think logically or to...
And not just to follow.
To ask questions. You see, yeah. I think going forward with the arrival AI and so forth, it's less about knowing the answers, more about how to ask questions.
But asking questions in our culture, Confucius, I mean, with a Confucius study, Confucius philosophy, you're only supplied to comply and obey. You're not supposed to question. So this is, I think the Asian's way, whether it is Chinese or Korean or Japanese, because you have this Confucius culture.
Yeah. I don't know the Japanese or Korean culture so well, but in China, there's a really interesting phenomenon, which is on the one hand is very Confucius. On the one hand, they are very good at taking exams, standardized exams. On the other hand, they're also extremely entrepreneurial.
That's very different.
Right? Yeah. It's a different thing.
You're
but they're trying to find loopholes, and just to put it in a very, you know, funny way, they identify opportunities very quickly and they think about how to solve that problem or get around it or tackle things in very creative ways. And that's not following
that's not
because so they have both.
But I think it's also because in Japan and Korea, they're very deep rooted in this in this culture. Even the mannerism, the way that they behave, they're more Confucius following Zen and then China. I think China is very interesting in all that. Mm. So then you went to Harvard, right? Mm-hmm. And then in Harvard, must be very competitive.
It was interesting that when the time when I was going to Harvard as an undergrad, there was at most one or two mainland Chinese students.
It must be not like now.
2000 to 2004. Yeah. Now there are dozens, if not more.
Yeah, of course.
So I think that's a big change. You know, what was really interesting is that, and this is, I'm living the transformation of China. You know, I get to the U.S., people's image of China was very different from the reality, quite dark, quite oppressive kind of that kind of environment where actually the Chinese were bidding for the Olympics and they were undertaking the most radical reforms in modern
radical
history.
Reforms, the early 2002.
And very, very optimistic about the future for good reason, because growth was really, you can feel the growth in the air. Meanwhile, in the U.S., it was slightly still the 1980s kind of image. But then when I got to college, you know, there were quite a few students taking Chinese, Mandarin, as a course. And then by the time I graduated, some of them wanted to go work in China. So that goes to show how things very quickly changed because of China's rise, because people knew about the dynamism in the Chinese economy.
But isn't that in early 2000? You know, China was hot. Was really hot because it's hot, and therefore the art has becomes really hot.
Yes, of course.
It's hot, and people want to do business, want to invest in China, and there's great hope. And U.S.-China relationship was really, really tight, and of course, then everything changes, right? Mm-hmm. Did you feel? I mean, at the time when you were there, it was really the best friendship of, you know,
there
the
was
best collaboration between US and China.
Honestly, I did, Pearl, because first of all, so many Chinese students went to study in the US. I was one of the beneficiaries of a great deal of, you know, American generosity to international students, and the idea that there has to be exchange, right? There has to be people-to-people connections, and we have to understand China and so forth. Actually, the high school principal that brought me over to the U.S. Wanted to do that because he wanted the school to know a different side of China.
A cultural exchange.
That kind of openness of mind was just, you know, really remarkable. I think a lot of things, great things came out of it, honestly, because Americans were doing business in China.
There were a lot of American investment.
And they did very, very well. You know, you search for growth opportunities once your opportunities kind of plateau in, you know, so it actually made a lot of sense to go into an emerging market that was developing very quickly and compared to other emerging markets had really radically different level of macroeconomic and political stability, right?
And there's also growth in
opportunities.
China.
Yeah. Stability was really crucial. Exchange rate stability, investment stability, and all that. So, but also Chinese scientists came to the U.S. and they worked for universities. They contributed to biotech and the technology companies. But, you know, even fast forward, if you think about it today, it's kind of ironic that from what I know, many of the people on the core research team of OpenAI are of Chinese heritage.
Yes.
So, you know.
And even Ming Xia invented the fingerprint recognition. It's Chinese.
So it's slightly difficult to fathom how you really can, you know, kind of break that link, right? That is deep. It's deeply embedded, especially in the innovation knowledge network, and has contributed so much to even America's technological progress. Obviously, China benefited hugely from trading with the U.S., from working with the U.S., and China rose. Now, but just more on a human level, the Chinese really admire the U.S.
Right? I know.
They really admire.
I know.
They were impressed.
You can see these big roads, big supermarkets.
Yes. American dream. It was totally on every single Chinese person's
mind. It was the American dream.
My generation, or at least the generation a little bit older than me, their whole life dream was go to the U.S., study, and get a job there and stay there forever. Now, those who actually stayed there now regret it because their compatriots who went back to China couldn't stay in the U.S. Actually, many of them ended up doing better. Yeah. Opportunities in China have grown so tremendously that the Chinese students, even with the best education background, they could have stayed in the U.S. and many of these top companies chose to go back to make it there, right? So that's voting with their feet. But honestly, the two countries were not direct competitors. I'd even argue that today, apart from some of the core technological areas, there's a lot more complementarity than we are admitting.
Okay, let's start from that. Okay, then you saw that China was growing and then you came to London, right? So what makes you stay in London instead of going back to America?
This is a personal preference. I wouldn't speak on behalf of other Chinese of my generation or my background. I just loved London for the multicultural
I think
background.
London is truly
It's
multicultural.
truly
Yeah, truly,
international.
yeah.
I think it's more international, more global than the United States, many of the cities in the United States. I think that, it's the thing about being in London is that you can be yourself from anywhere and you can fit in. I always felt in the US, you kind of had to be more American to fit in. But in London, you can really just kind of be yourself. And again, I think less judgmental.
Oh, London is not judgmental. Not like
I think
France.
as,
France is judgmental. London is not judgmental.
So, yeah.
London, I think British are more self-centered. They don't really care what you do.
In a very self-deprecating way as well.
Exactly.
But also, I'm a big fan of culture. My father's a Shakespearean scholar. I'm a classic pianist, and I obviously appreciate art as well. And so you see the confluence of the art world, the business world, the political world. Academia is fantastic. London School of Economics, one of the best economics department in the world, was fantastic. It was you were in the wider world rather than in a bubble or an ivory tower where you saw only a certain part of the world. And so here it, even though London's a great cosmopolitan city, it did open my eyes again to the realities of a more complex world.
There is a lot of miscommunication between the West and China. This miscommunication is really pretty deep because I think each of the countries should have someone who really understand what they want. And then later on, I find out, I mean, the West become intimidated by China. Whereas what, I think it's about a whole misunderstanding about each of the nations.
The misunderstanding or the misgivings is really at the core of the problem. I honestly fundamentally do not see US and China necessarily at loggerheads with each other because China is not an imperialist country.
No,
China
not at
is, I
all.
think it's a totally wrong comparison to put China in the bucket of Iran and North Korea and
Yeah.
Russia, which is what Washington, D.C. is doing. This misgiving goes so deep on so many levels, but even culturally. I remember the time when I arrived as a high school student, in China, the thing that you want to do as a student is to be number one.
Yeah, of course,
It's very,
obviously.
you're proud to be number one, or you strive to be number
Yeah.
one. Whereas in an American high school, you would never, ever want to say that you want to be number one. That would be a fatal mistake. And
Yeah.
even though many people wanted to be number one, they will
And they
hide
won't
it.
say
They
it.
won't say it, right? So that's a cultural thing. And I also remember, I talk about my parents often, I talk about my parents and what their desires, even though I don't always listen to them. I mentioned my parents once in front of my Harvard thesis advisors, and they kind of drop their jaws and like, why are you mentioning your parents? And all my Chinese students in the London School of Economics, they sit in my office, we're discussing your future plans. Almost 85 to 90% of them start with, well, my parents think that I should blah blah blah. And so it's a very cultural thing. I'm an extremely independent person. I do refer to my parents, I do refer to my family, but I think just the relationship with authority is so different,
And also, it's very respectful.
It's very
And
respectful.
also, you always want to
This
mention
is
because it
not
shows
blind, yeah, but
your
this is
respect.
not blind submission.
No.
They confuse it in the
But they see
West
it as
as something of so
you're not
paternalism,
independent.
or they attribute to authoritarianism. It's
Yeah.
not
Or
that. It's a respect,
yeah,
but
respect.
it's not blind submission, right? It's even, it's more, it's a more fluid relationship. It's more balanced, a more harmonious relationship. So we do refer to our families quite often. And see, so I think that this is just a simple example of how deep this misunderstanding runs. And I think that a lot of the traveling helped to convey a different
Yeah.
side of China, a more humane side of China, because a lot of the misgivings lie in the political system, right? And the role of the government. Again, if we come back to this idea of what's your relationship with authority? It's not necessarily that we're submitting to the government or we're being submissive or being oppressed by anybody. It's a contract. It's an implicit contract that we've had for thousands of years where in exchange for security, the government is held accountable for your welfare. And simple things like that. Of course, it's more complicated. But you see, I think this is at the core of the U.S.-China tension, is that they think we have a political system that is oppressive.
No, I think the problem with America is that they think their system is the best. Everybody has to follow their system. So it's like Bush said, either you are for me or against me. You know, it's...
It's a complex world.
It's not an open-minded that, you know, you have a different system, you have a different culture. I respect your culture, I respect your system. It's not.
This is not the way that U.S. as a hegemonic power has looked onto the world. I think China's worldview, you know, against their for all of the things that it needs to change, and I think there are to be in more harmony with the world. Still, China believes in coexistence of differences.
I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, right? Well, this is not looking at using one lens to look at the world. And again, in my book, I tried to show that there's not just one model that works, right? There's no just one principle that that has to be, you know, that the only one. And that the multiplicity of religion, of political systems, of economic models, of different forms of institutional arrangements can coexist. And until we recognize that, until we acknowledge the coexistence of a beautiful tapestry, a mosaic of cultures and systems, can we then go on to say, how are we going to work together, right? If you use one lens to look at the world and expect everybody to be the same, that's not going to work.
I always say that today we have to celebrate differences.
Yeah, and even as we talk about democracy versus non-democracy, I think this is, again, the wrong framing.
Really, I think so. I think so. I think democracy works in certain ways, but also democracy. I think Socrates said democracy, you need to have everybody who has this similar education, similar intellectual power before you really can have true democracy.
Yeah, I think that we should discuss more about what makes a successful society, right? Rather than put labels, because the labels are not working. The GCC countries, China, all these middle powers, big powers rising, doing so well successfully. Many of them are not democracies. What makes society successful? I think there are lessons to be drawn there, rather than carving the world into different spheres that I think are so blurred in the first place and really not helpful.
But I mean, America today is no better than Britain during the colonialism period. It's exactly
it's being very.
But they're not helping themselves.
It's shooting itself in the foot.
Yeah, with this terrorist, with kicking out illegal immigrants, trying to arresting judge and all that.
It's so shocking that this happens in America. Telling the universities,
America, who is promoting the last democracy?
Place in the world you think that this would happen, but you know, telling universities that you can't take in certain students,
and then they want to control the hiring, and then look at the visa. I mean, come on.
And then the imperialist drive, as we see a glimpse of the end of Russia, Ukraine. Now it's what, the United States, the imperialist, right?
There is deep rooted misunderstanding between the West and the East. If the West does not understand the position of China, they find intimidating.
I think this confidence, right? Certainly it's founded on something, which is very successful economic growth. Of course, China is not really a rich country yet, right? So maybe that came a little bit early. Maybe the pronouncement that China is going to dominate the world in technology didn't go down so well with Washington, D.C.
You immediately create competitors, right?
So I think there's some of that, but also I think actually, even on the business level, if you think about it, American businessmen, European businessmen used to make money in China.
Yeah.
And over time, they made less and less and less money. Okay. And I think that is also a factor because they Absolutely. Were the biggest proponents of keeping engagement with China, keeping China open with the US. And they made less money. Now, part of it, they blame on the discriminatory policies of the Chinese government. I think there was a bit of...
Is that true?
In the past, there was a bit of truth to it, although not completely true. Because again, we've looked at the data. Actually, foreign companies got, on average, more subsidies than domestic companies, domestic private companies. And domestic SOEs, state-owned enterprises, also got more subsidies than domestic private companies. Because a lot of the foreign
SOE
companies...
always get.
Yeah, a lot of foreign companies benefited from these export subsidies because they were mainly exporting to the rest of the world. There was maybe not the same level playing field, especially when you had the state-owned enterprises involved. So I can totally see that there was definitely... It was definitely there. But the important thing is that you fast forward many years later, you take away these subsidies. And by the way, a lot of these subsidies are not in place anymore. China has become so fiercely competitive.
Yes.
And it's cutthroat competition of the most ferocious kind in the world. It's very, very difficult for American, European companies to survive unless you really, truly bring something different onto the table, right? So there are many, many successful companies, Apple being one of them, Estee Lauder, et cetera, but a lot of them were just pushed out also by domestic competition. I think the expiration date has long passed when you still blame Chinese subsidies on things because 95% of the manufacturing sector follow market trends, meaning there's no overinvestment, there's no government intervention. So I think that's an old conversation. But I just think that if China was able to open up more quickly, more sectors for foreign companies to make money, especially in the financial sector,
exactly.
where the US can, you know, really benefit in the service industries, I think things would have been a little bit better.
But having said all that, when I look at the trade imbalance, because that trade imbalance, they did not take into account of the service industry. If you take into account the service industry, would there still be a trade imbalance?
Because the US runs a trade surplus with China on the services.
Yeah.
But you see, the it's all very politicized.
Exactly.
So it's all about manufacturing jobs, which is very hard to understand why Trump is so interested in low-end manufacturing being brought back to the United States.
Because he wants employment, because he got the vote,
yes,
right?
Yes, but every steel job that they saved in Trump 1.0, they lost in the tens of thousands of other sectors' employment because when steel prices go up, all the downstream sectors actually were worse off.
Yeah.
And so for the tens of thousands of steel jobs they save, they lost a lot more on net. But again, it's a political problem, right? We all understand that this is, you know, this brings more efficiency, maybe more distributional consequences. But China's manufacturing dominance is not because of the subsidies, right? Yes, maybe subsidy in the beginning helped, but the level of competition, the level of efficiency in terms of supply chain.
Yeah, efficiency. And also, I just read, now China has all the robots. It's
50%
really,
of the global
robots
is, you know, exports is accounted for by China. So China has a different level and scale of efficient supply chain.
And I was
chain.
Told that even, I read, even that America would take back the manufacturing, they would not have the output and the efficiency and the quality of China.
Right. So the dominance lies in so many different factors. And I think it's just years of experience and scale and supply chain coordination, which China has mastered. Think about the company Shein. Unfortunately, it's not exempt to this tariffs, but so prices have doubled. But they've doubled from, I don't know, $8 per dress to $16. But it comes from efficiency of supply chain. Trump, in many ways, is right about certain things, even though the strategy and tactics are wrong. He pointed out some of these problems, and it's a lot of it is a domestic U.S. problem, right? But China faces a similar challenge in terms of how to take globalization and how to be part of it that leads to more balanced, right? It's and then it's about rebalancing. It's not about maximizing
No.
efficiency. Right now, China has been maximizing efficiency, and you're absolutely right. It has benefited so many different countries and companies because everybody got things cheaper, right?
At least it helped them with the inflation.
For sure, if you look at again, I look at the data, US
Yes.
inflation in the last 20 years, all the inflation comes from services, not from
Absolutely.
manufacturing.
You know.
And this is because of China. So, but it's not well recognized and well appreciated because you go to Walmart, yes, now you know that some of this is made in China, or you always knew that, but
Majority is made in
you always
China.
knew that, but you just didn't really internalize how much it kept the prices down, right? But you focus on the tens of thousands of steel jobs or manufacturing jobs that were displaced. Now the US consumers are going to feel it because back to school in September, all these school
Everything
supplies
will be, yeah, and
will
even
look
toys, all the pencils, everything.
I think that we, and I'm an economist, and the first thing that we economists have to think about is we need to incorporate some of the more human aspects into the whole efficiency argument, right? And that's never been featured in the model. So it's not only about balance within countries, it's balance across countries. It's about China figuring out how to be in a harmonious relationship with all else while offering the efficiencies and the innovations it can, but holding back a bit, right? The new generation really shows a much softer, more humane side of China that when we talk about the misgivings, I think we do need to focus on them. If you see it through their lens, their eyes, actually China's fascinating, like for the
It
reasons
is.
that
It
you
is.
mentioned, the convenience, but also the
Yeah.
very tech innovation oriented,
Very
very
tight. Yeah.
futuristic, very funny, humorous, you
Yeah.
know. I remember there's an influencer, an American, Black American influencer, Speed, gathers about 25 million views on his, you know, trips to China's second tier cities, Chongqing. I mean, they were so amazed by what China's like. Chongqing looks like Shanghai, looks like any other
Chongqing, I
major.
think, with the mountain and the sea, it looks like Hong Kong.
Well, it looks like many
Yeah.
cosmopolitan. And I remember there's a person who's selling his goose, right? His delicious goose, and has been following this guy 4 months, day in, day out, just to get more publicity. I mean, it's really genuine.
See, it's
And they
sweet.
became the best of friends
So sweet,
without
yeah.
speaking the common
Sitting.
language. But this is the real China, right? This is Chinese people. Chinese people and their love of, you know, doing things, their high spiritedness, all this
And they're
is
hardworking.
hardworking, but you know, with a very interesting
Yeah.
view of life in the world. I think all of this is not captured in any of the state-to-state discussions, but China does have this softer and more humane side
Absolutely.
that doesn't get appreciated. I think most people who traveled to China, who've been there, changed their minds about China
Yeah,
from
absolutely,
reading the
absolutely.
newspapers, right?
My next question for
So,
you is one child policy.
yes.
I read that you actually did an analysis on the impact of one child policy. Now, what we know is India is still with a huge younger generation. The factories, they're still using a lot of hands. They, you know, the labor is not a problem. Then you see in Japan, the aging people is more than the younger people. They are having problems. China, again, you have the aging population. So now, of course, China, they changed the whole policy that
Yes,
you can
a little
have,
too late.
yeah, a bit too late, right? So how are you going to see this one-child policy affecting the public finance and the economy, China economy?
I think that aging demographics is obviously what people believe to be one of the biggest challenges for China's economy. I actually stand in the other camp of the minority who that don't believe that this is a first order issue. I
Okay.
believe it's an issue. I don't think it's a first order issue. Before going to the social issues, which I think there are more interesting consequences than the economic one, in China, you still have hundreds of millions of undereducated, underemployed people living in the countryside,
Exactly. And some of
keeping
them are still illiterate as well.
exactly,
Yeah.
and that's still part of a potential labor force that can be much more productive mm-hmm. and can add to the economy. So China isn't really in a point where it's like Japan and Europe in terms of the labor force mm-hmm. contribution to the economy. I'm much more about productivity than about number of people, right? Okay. If you look at what AI is doing, even looking at the last 30 years of manufacturing, but labor productivity rising by 10 to 15% per year, labor force potentially shrinking by 0.1, 0.5% per year. You know, it's about how efficient you become. And so the younger generation, at least until this point, are still earning a lot more than the previous generation yes. in the same age. So it's because of the rising opportunity. I also think that we don't know what's going to happen with the arrival of AI, right? Robotics, yes, automation. Yes,
true. Absolutely.
We're worried about not enough jobs for people. And at the same time, we're worried about, you know, kind of too few people in China. And there is a little bit of a contradiction there. Yeah. So definitely I think that with AI, we don't even really know what it means to work in the future, right? How we're going to spend our day, our everyday life, you know, doing things. So it's hard to say economically it's a clear path, because I think that the arrival of AI this time around is so fundamentally transformative, even more so than the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century.
I agree. Absolutely. Because it changed the whole, I mean, the whole formula, the whole protocol, everything changed.
The potential is so vast.
The potential is vast.
I think we're you know, talking about this demographic pressure in the next, I don't know, 20, 30 years. Yeah, but, you know, lots of things are changing.
Oh, since you're talking about AI and technology, the general thing is when I went to China, people would say, oh, America is stopping us from growing and we could have conquered the world. We couldn't do it. We could have been number one in the world and now we are being controlled. We could not share the best technology, blah, 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 blah.
No, I think this is a
your
a,
comment.
I think this is a false argument. Number one, I think the export controls and the tech restrictions accelerated China's development. If we look throughout...
accelerated. Look at DeepSeek.
Exactly. DeepSeek came out under pressure. Yeah. A lot of the biggest technological breakthroughs happen under crises and pressure, not when times are really good. Actually, if you look at the Chinese semiconductor industry, when the Chinese decided to import semiconductors from Americans, the whole industry stalled for 20 years.
Because I was told by some of the engineers and some of the company, they said that they can buy from America.
I know, why would you bother?
Why do we still have to pay R&D?
Yeah, yeah,
why
yeah.
do we have to invest in R&D? Exactly. Now all of a sudden they have...
And in the last few years, the improvement has been so rapid. It's been so rapid. It would have not been possible without these controls in place. If you look at the Shanghai Semicon conference, I'm told by the experts, the degree of domestic capacity now is enormous, with very few gaps really left in between. And I think in a very short amount of time, China would be mostly able to satisfy domestic, but also with the help of Japan and Korea, which is not only of the U.S. camp. This would have not been possible at that speed were it not for these controls. But also, it's also elicited almost a wartime mobilization.
Yes, I do.
And a whole of a nation program, right? Everyone's on it. Alibaba, all the private companies, they all want to tackle the biggest choke points to Chinese technology. But again, if we look back throughout history, it's always under pressure that these kind of breakthroughs happen very often. But even with Europe, right now, the Trump and the wake-up call, they have to do more. They have to do more investment, defense, and technology. But in China, it's actually really, really happening, because there was a real existential crisis a few years ago that China would be cut out from the critical tech supply chain. I think it's much less concerned now. So I don't agree with that statement. But also, it's still up to China, right? If we look at most of the policies, whether it's China, the UK, or America, the worst policies are always self-inflicted.
It's true.
It's never coming from abroad, right? They can do a bit. Sometimes they can actually help you against their will. But the most dramatic bad policies are always self-inflicted. So I think only China can stop China's rise, just like the U.S., right? The U.S. is its biggest threat to progress, if I may say so.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pearl.
Thank you, Kayu. It's such an interesting conversation. I could speak with you another hour.
Yes, likewise.
I don't want to keep you here.
Thanks for having me, Pearl.
Thank you. Thank you, Kayu.